Working Cows Podcast, Episode 42.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Everybody, it's Clay Connery here, the host of the Working Cows Podcast. Just totally blown away and overwhelmed by the support and people reaching out to me and new opportunities coming down the pike. It's just been a great experience thus far. Thank you so much for joining me. Continue to like and share social media posts and content that we're pushing out. Just really helps get the word out there and share it with one person. Just find somebody who you think would be interested in the discussions we're having here on a weekly basis and share that with them if you wouldn't mind. So today is another one of those guests who reached out to me. I was kind of trying to find a guest and I put it out there that I was looking for a guest, and he reached out to me and said, hey, I would do it. I don't have time this week, but I could do it next week. And so Cody Creelman is a cow veterinarian near Airdrie, Alberta, Canada, and he reached out to me, and he was on his way to the New Harvest 2018 conference at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he said that he wanted to have a discussion about disruptions in the market. And so we're going to sit down here with Cody and have a chat about what this conference and the subject of the conference have to do with disruptions in the meat market, the beef market specifically. So, Cody, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you have recently returned from the New Harvest Conference in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. That's a tongue twister. Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And kind of just give people a background a little bit about what that conference was about.
Yeah, so that was the New Harvest 2018 conference. New Harvest is a non-for-profit group that promotes scientific advancement outside of institutions in the cellular agriculture space. And their conference that they have put on, I think this was the third one, is just a joining of minds and talking about all the different issues that are happening with cellular agriculture. So I met so many different people there. They were founders, startup guys, scientists. There was people from all across the world, from academic institutions to guys who were growing meat in their own kitchen in these kind of modified microwaves and everybody in between. It was a pretty amazing group. There was even agriculture representation there, which was interesting too, because I didn't really see any farmers to start. And then after I gave my talk, they started coming out of the woodwork. So I saw farm boys galore, farm girls galore coming out, people who were working in different capacities. And for example, a girl who's working at a PR firm, she came up after and she said, hey, I just want to say I'm from Texas and I was part of FAA. What is it? FFA?
Yep, Future Farmers of America.
I'm Canadian, so forgive me. So yeah, they were just like all these farmer people that were interested in the space as well that were part of this conversation. It was pretty great.
So how does a Canadian vet end up at the New Harvest 2018 conference?
Yeah, so that is quite the question. I kind of stuck my big fat nose into the conference. The long story is I've always been fascinated in kind of following the money of the beef cattle industry. So where is their divestment? Where is their investment? And kind of just keeping my eye out for paradigm shifts, changes, opportunities. It's just kind of one of the things I do as a person whose entire livelihood is invested into the beef cattle industry. I like to keep a pulse on it. And I had noted that I thought that I was seeing some divestment of money out of the feedlot space and being put back into alternative proteins. So the classic would be Cargill divesting out of their feedlots in the U.S. and they were putting money into alternative protein, and I was interested into what that actually meant and just kept going down the rabbit hole, and that's where I found Memphis Meats, this startup in I think it's San Francisco, where Cargill has invested, Tyson's now invested, Richard Branson's invested, Bill Gates has invested. So this cellular agriculture, this cultured meat company, and I started looking at the technology, went down the rabbit hole even further, found the conference proceedings from the year prior, which had just had really just came out on YouTube when I had found them. I think it was like the seventh person to watch the last year's conference, and became fascinated with it. And there was this lady who was emceeing last year's conference, and I was like, she's super smart and she seems extremely practical, and it seems like she understands both sides of the conversation. And it ended up being the CEO of New Harvest, of this non-for-profit group. And when I looked into her, she was actually from my home province. She was a Canadian from Alberta who had taken a meat science class, and there was a lot of parallels in our education, and we're from the same place. So I had just reached out to her, and we had a couple conversations, and I just basically said, hey, I'm a beef cattle vet from your home province. Let's chat.
Very cool. So what is cellular agriculture? What is cultured meat, craft meat, whatever you're going to call it? What is it?
Just don't call it clean meat, right?
Right. I got that. I got that from the end of your podcast. So.
Yeah. Well, I guess you can call it whatever you want. I was advocating that we should just call it something different altogether. We should just call it an arbitrary name like Jim, because it doesn't matter at the end of the day, I don't think, anyways. So cellular agriculture is essentially just using technology, whether that's plant-based, whether that's fungi, whether that's animal cells, and using technology to propagate materials and foodstuffs and proteins, enzymes, basically animal cells in a brewer's vat. The same way we make beer, people can make all kinds of fancy things.
Well, I like the sounds of that.
That's how I usually explain it to producers, and I've been practicing this for a little while. I usually have to go with the term lab-grown meat first. I think that kind of is most popular within our side of the media, within the agriculture industry, and I will say that we can be just as inflammatory in our media and propagating words and wording around that technology, just as bad as the other side is in using words like clean meat. So Franken chicken and all these not very nice terms. But I usually end up saying lab-grown meat first, and then the response I get from farmers and producers when I'm talking to them is usually ew. And then I start talking a bit more about the technology, as to it's extremely high tech, but it's really not that different than the way we make beer. We have base cells that we're adding substrate to, and we're getting an end product out, and that can be a variety of different products. It could be leather, it could be meat, it could be milk, it could be eggs, a thousand different things, a million different things.
So what are the characteristics of lab-grown meat, or Jim, as you called it at the end of your podcast?
Jim is going to catch on. I was joking, I should have a startup company for next year's conference just called Jim. I think it would take off for
sometimes
sure.
Sometimes all it so takes to get rich is to get the patent in the right timing.
Exactly. So the characteristics are very varied right now. There's a lot of companies kind of operating in this veil of secrecy, and there's some companies that are very out in the open and showing the products that they're creating. They can create a lot of very interesting different types of meat, the biggest question is the cost, right? So what sort of what does the consumer facing first product look like? And that doesn't exist yet. There isn't a consumer facing product yet, but it's becoming very close. So as far as I can garner, the easiest thing to do would be like a finely textured meat, right? So mechanically separated chicken or mechanically separated beef, like those are the texture and the scaffolding, the amount of technology and resources that they're putting into trying to figure out all of the different layers and what meat actually is, and multiple layers of using, you know, that you have nerves and you have adipose tissue, you have vasculature layered all around this kind of subcellular matrix, and then you have your final muscle cells intermixed and all of that. Like that's extremely complicated, but they're working towards it for sure. There's technology there of basically using like a laser jet printer where you put the vessel cells inside the cartridge, and then you're printing out vasculature, and then you have your muscle cells in another cartridge, and you're printing out your muscle, and then at the end you have this layered product that you have to incubate and provide electrical stimulation. But yeah, they don't have a T-bone. They don't have, you know, something that would be analogous to a roast, but they're getting extremely close and kind of the more simplistic ones, ground beef, finely textured beef, liver pate, those types of things.
So those things, they're still close on the finely textured meat, or are they there? Is that what you're saying?
They're there. There's just no consumer-facing product yet. Not something that you could go out to Whole Foods and purchase.
Were there any samples at the conference?
No samples at the conference. And I think a lot of that is food safety, regulatory issues. That would be the last thing that anybody would ever want. There was a lot of people that had tried it. There was certainly some media that had been given that opportunity when they go and visit these places. But in terms of offering that at a large-scale event, I think it was just too big of a risk.
Yeah, I can see the cattle lobby getting a hold of that and making headlines with it. You know, a bunch of people at a Franken meat conference poisoned by unclean meat or something. You know, I mean,
exactly.
They have a day
for sure.
So is the end goal to have the meat product, Jim, be indistinguishable from the ranch-raised product? I mean, are they going to sit side-by-side like the dairy cooler with, as I heard at a Farm Bureau conference one time, somebody say nut juice because you can't call it milk. Is that the end goal, to have a spot in the meat cooler with these different products?
I think that is part of it. It's that and more. It is as varied as the products could potentially be. It's also what are the potential use cases, and there is a lot more flexibility within that system when you're not confined into the bioreactor of the pig or the bioreactor of the cow. So there is companies that certainly would love to have that sort of spot, that spot as an alternative choice. There's also the opportunity to help augment places that don't have access to high-quality protein, where something like ground beef is a great expense and hard, difficult supply chain to move through. So there could be a potential to displace that. And then there's also companies much more, I guess, forward-thinking in thinking that maybe we wouldn't be displacing what's in the meat counter. Maybe we're creating a product that's new altogether. Just because we eat chicken, pork, and beef right now doesn't mean your favorite meat isn't angelfish or wallaby or anaconda. Like the cell base isn't confined to the traditional species that we eat today. The reason we eat a chicken, a cow, and a pig is because they were relatively easy to domesticate in comparison to a lion and a woolly mammoth, right? Like we didn't pick them because they taste good. We picked them because their ancestors had some sort of predilection to hang around our villages, and through thousands of years we were able to do a true domestication. Not because we love chicken meat.
We picked the lazy meat.
We picked the lazy meat, we did. So that's what I mean, is there's companies that are saying, like, you know, we're not even going to be focused on a beef product in the future, because that might not even be the right choice for us. We could do so many different things and add different flavor profiles. Like, the ability for them to design a specific or a bunch of specific products is as far as your imagination could reach. That you could have an anaconda meat base that has been braised in white wine and added the essence of thyme, all within the culture process. That isn't going to compete with beef in the cooler.
Are there the same constraints on this product when it is produced as there are on a beef product, as far as storing and shipping and some of those things?
Well, that still has yet to be determined. I met this super fascinating meat scientist. I think he was from West Texas. And he was there basically to be part of the conversation to make sure this industry didn't screw up things like packaging and supply chain and safe food handling practices, because that's what he does every single day. They're so focused on this, raising of the capital to create this product, this consumer-facing product, that I don't think a lot of them have gone that next step. And that was the beautiful thing of the conference, a beautiful realization of the conference, in that all of the opportunities that our industry could provide to really lend a hand and to show them all of the different challenges that we're facing, and to not kind of reinvent the wheel again.
What were some of your takeaways from the conference as far as where is this technology going, some of the different opportunities maybe outside of the meat space?
Yeah, I think that was a really important thing that I didn't know what to expect at all. I didn't know the demographic. I didn't know the groups. I didn't know what the general sense would be. And I came away with this kind of thought that there was two divergent groups kind of forming under the same umbrella. So you certainly had these startup founders, these scientists that were drawn to this space because of their morals, because of their ethics, and they wanted to feel like they were doing something important with their work, with their life, and they truly were not advocates of existing animal agriculture practices. So I was talking to one of the founders, and I said, how do you... And he was a vegan, and I said, like, how do you rationalize different animal production settings in terms of what you consider good and what you consider bad? And his view was very simplistic. He just said calories per life. He had boiled down everything that we do, everything that this industry does to however many calories you get out of a single life, that was bad. So, for example, a chicken to him was not as sustainable or not as welfare friendly, because you would only get X number of calories out of a single life. Whereas if you were producing an elephant, that would be much more ethical and moral, because you were only getting... You would get that many more calories out of a single life. So no sort of consideration for sentience, no consideration for production standards, no consideration for geographical considerations. You know, a pig raised in Canada does not equal a pig raised in a third world country. There's so many different considerations. So there was the people who completely wanted to end animal agriculture, period. That with their technology, they would be able to just disrupt with analogous products and then also create superior products, and animal agriculture would be destroyed, and there would be no ethical or moral issues with it anymore, or environmental. So that was the first group. The second group were people who were just genuinely fascinated in the technology and in the space, who were proponents of animal agriculture who saw opportunities within animal agriculture. And I think that came to light even more so after I got to talk to some of those groups. And a lot of them did recognize that there was this huge amount of opportunity to help and improve what we're doing in animal agriculture using the technology that they're using today. They're creating some spectacular things that we could be using.
Sure. Yeah. And you give some examples of that in your podcast, which will be linked at the show notes page, workingcows.net/42. A couple of examples you gave in your podcast were colostrum and a leather patch, essentially, or skin patch instead of sutures. So workingcows.net/42 will have a link to all of Cody's information and his podcast episode where he debriefed his time at the New Harvest 2018 conference, and a link to his blog channel and all that. So be sure to check that out. But continuing on this discussion, you had an opportunity to interact with a bunch of different people who were themselves vegans, and I don't know what Canada is like, but in Western South Dakota, I don't run into a terrible lot of them. I've been out to eat with a few vegetarians, and they have a hard time ordering off of a menu in Western South Dakota, and we don't interact with those people a whole lot. What were their motivations, or did you talk to them about their motivations for becoming a vegan, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. I talked, and the answer varied greatly. So sometimes it was they had become interested in how they get their meat, and then what they would do is go down the YouTube rabbit hole and come across a bunch of really horrible videos and then make the decision. Some would have been part of a lecture, some would have had a friend, some would have been involved in some sort of group. A lot of this self-research was extremely popular, that anything you search on the internet, you can usually validate an idea. Like, I could think that any sort of conspiracy theory, if I believed in it, I could validate it through a few Google searches. So a lot of it was that, for sure. Very few was, I worked at a farm and saw this and thought that was terrible, or I visited a farm. I asked that question over and over again and gave multiple offers to anybody who wants to come on a ride along to come visit my ranches. Most of them had not ever experienced being in a pig barn or a dairy barn or at a feedlot. And I kept saying, like, you guys need to recognize that we don't think that the industry is perfect either, but we're working towards it every single day to improve it, to make it better, that we recognize all of the follies and issues. And that's why I have a job. Like, my job is to take less than ideal management practices and natural illnesses and try to educate and change management systems and train producers and implement strategies. Like, we're kind of all working towards the same thing in reality. We are trying to improve animal health and welfare.
Do you think that many of the people you talked to, their motivation was an environmental motivation? Was that?
So it was part of the conversation sometimes, but it was, I would say, not very well informed. And one of the things that was not recognized, or the animal industry wasn't given accolades to, was how much we have improved in the last 50 years. So, for example, there would be a person up on stage talking about why they are doing what they're doing. So let's say somebody who's creating do-it-yourself meat culture kits, standing on stage and saying, I got into this because I learned that animal agriculture was bad and it has a significant negative impact on the environment, period. No sort of conversation around that, very glossed over. I feel like they don't really understand things like marginal lands. They don't understand that we can't eat all of the calories that we produce. It's just not suitable for human consumption. All of the things that animal agriculture does within our food chain, they certainly don't understand. One of the most fascinating things, a part of that environmental conversation, was one of the presenters, Jack Bobo. So he is vice president for Intrexon, which is basically the most interesting company you've never heard of. So they're the ones that made the Arctic apple, this never browning apple, and the Aqua Bounty
Salmon.
Yeah, so this like super fast growing salmon. So he was there and he had a super interesting perspective on things, and he said he gave animal agriculture huge accolades, showing how much less resources it takes to produce a kilo of beef or a kilo of chicken, and how we've improved so tremendously over the last 40 to 50 years. And he also said, yes, there is significant environmental impacts that animal agriculture has, that agriculture in general has. We do leave a footprint. There's no question. But he also said that this is really the worst that it's ever going to be, because we're improving these technologies greatly. And he had this stat, and he said, what do you think the population of the Earth is going to be in the year 2300? And I had given the answer, hopefully no more than 9 billion. And he's kind of smiled and nodded, and he said, it's 3.5 billion. So if you took some predictive modeling, it shows that the Earth's population is going to peak in 2050, and if we can just make sure that everybody gets fed until that point, then the rest is just going to be an easy ride. That was fascinating to me, because I think the media completely hypes up to this 2050 number, but nobody talks past that, because if you talk past that, you're lying, because then the number starts to go down.
Yeah, the media, their job is to make sure that we're terrified of something at all times.
Exactly. So everybody's terrified of 2050. And I've even seen huge multinationals, you know, jump on this Feed the Nine by 2050 bandwagon. And I do think it's important for us to all work hard to feed the nine. But we should probably also be putting systems in place, because we are going to have to feed the 3.5 as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you reached out to me, you were on your way to the conference, and you reached out kind of on the basis of talking about the disruption that this lab-grown meat or Jim is going to cause in the beef cow industry and the meat industry in general. What are your thoughts on that after the conference?
Yeah, so the first thing is, I do think that technology disrupts every industry, and technology will disrupt animal agriculture. I don't know when that'll happen, and I don't know what technology that is, but it's an inevitability that if you don't believe, then you're naive. It happened with ice production, it happened with transportation, and it's happened with food multiple times. The advent of the domestication of the cow has completely disrupted the traditional hunter and gathering industry because of that technology. It's just going to happen. So that was part of my interest. I'm always fascinated with thinking about paradigm shifts, especially paradigm shifts that directly impact myself and my organization, my farmers, my friends. And that was one of the things that I was wondering about, is this technology the one that's going to disrupt it? And the answer is still yes. I do believe that cellular agriculture will disrupt it, but not necessarily in the way that I thought to begin with. One of the biggest take-homes was one of the general frustrations that I've had within animal agriculture is the lack of technological resources that I've had. When I go out and ride in a big four-wheel drive tractor planting wheat with some of my clients, I'm just always blown away by all the technology that they now have. I feel like there's been this divergence of technology from the grain and the cattle side over the last 20 years, where the grain guys have just exploded. loaded, and they're, you know, daily satellite imagery and LIDAR and autosteer and precision agriculture and like on the spot soil testing. Like, it's just like phenomenal what they're doing from a technology side. And I feel like us on the cattle side, while we've made improvements, there's still a lot of things that I think technology could solve in terms of helping us improve what we do, whether that's disease detection, whether that's quantifying antimicrobial use, whether that is through genomics, genetic selection. Like, there's so many different things. When I was walking around MIT, and when I was in the media lab, and when I was listening to all of these amazing presentations, like, the technology that they're using and they're developing is phenomenal. This was the brightest room that I'd ever been in. There was PhDs up the wazoo, and I just started thinking, what if instead of trying to hopscotch over animal agriculture, what if these resources were put in inside of animal agriculture and were tools that we could use? All of these different things we could use within animal agriculture to feed the nine, but also improve animal health and welfare. And I don't think anybody's recognizing that. And even from their own perspective, that's like, to me, seems like the easier path to start with. That, let's say you're developing this new technology to create algae, right? And you want to have this algae consumer-facing product where people are buying your high-quality algae powder because it has all the micro and macronutrients you could ever want. It's a lot easier to feed that to a pig if you can produce it cheap enough and give a really high-quality designer feedstock than it is to have all go through all the regulatory hoops. Like, there's so many different things that we can do with what they are doing. And like I said, like, the ability to create designer colostrum or a designer carbohydrate that we could decrease methane production. Like, these people could do that. They could put us on another plane of how we raise animals for the better. There's no question.
You know, it's also a lot easier to convince somebody to eat a pig that ate algae than it is to convince somebody that they should eat algae themselves.
Exactly. Well, and that's a very good comment that I had brought up. Because everybody was trying to hopscotch over animal agriculture, and I said, you're missing out on a huge market opportunity. You're missing out on a huge opportunity for you to generate capital, because if something works, then producers are going to buy it. Farmers are going to buy whatever your product is, which could fund your next round of technology. It's extremely expensive to make a consumer-facing product, like a B2C, where you have the ability to focus on one little narrow aspect that could improve animal agriculture. And you're exactly right. Once pigs have been eating a cellular agriculture product for 20 years, people are going to be also a lot more accepting of that. That's like a common feedstock, and now we have this food grade, or this human food grade version. They're going to be very accepting of that.
You know, another piece of this disruption thing, it sounds really scary. Disruption sounds really scary because I don't know how to adapt, or I don't know what that's going to look like. But thinking about it in even a more recent example, you know, the ice industry was disrupted in my grandparents' lifetime. But the tractor and tractors, as they have grown, have disrupted the agriculture industry. You know, I heard somebody talking about this recently, and they called it basically a robot. The tractor is a robot. It's a labor-saving robot, you know.
Right.
And the economy has adapted to that disruption, and we don't have lower unemployment now than we did before tractors came on. We've just got a whole bunch of new, the entertainment industry and the expansion of that and the experience economy and the expansion of that and those things. The economy just adapted to absorb this new labor force that wasn't needed on the farm anymore. And so I think that's the same. You know, that's going to be the same. This disruption sounds scary, but the economy always adapts. And then the other thing that comes to mind is I think I lost that nugget, but
No, but if you take that thought experiment forward as to, okay, let's say there's a product in Amazon, so you go onto Amazon and you type in ground beef, and there's a product that is $1 per pound cheaper of ground beef that is produced by cellular agriculture versus conventional agriculture. So they have an analogous product and it's cheaper than what we can produce. That to me is a true disruption. Now the consumer shifts. Consumers buy on price and they buy on taste. They buy on a lot of other things, but those are the top two, at least in my opinion. So as long as it tastes good and as long as they know it's going to be somewhat safe to eat, and it's not expensive, they're gonna buy it. They vote with their wallets every single day, and people are generally cheap. It's just a simple fact. So now that disruption has happened, yeah, go through the thought experiment of what does happen to these producers, what happens to these farmers, these stewards of the land. They still have their land base, right? We haven't taken that away from them. They still have the ability to compete in the commodity market. They still have the ability to now divert silage corn into grain corn. Like there's so many different things that they can do. And sure, there's going to be places that have marginal lands, but maybe it makes sense to still be raising cattle on those marginal lands, and you're creating a different product altogether. That maybe you're not producing a 1,600 pound AAA steer because a different company can do it for cheaper and better. But maybe you're able to create a 1,000 pound steer that you can sell into the Indochina market. And you can do that cheaper and more economically because you're utilizing these different resources. Like, there's so many different opportunities. You're exactly right. I think the biggest disruption that I would be scared of is the truck driving industry and auto steering vehicles. Like, that's going to be way more of an issue than I think the disruption of animal agriculture within the U.S. Like, truck driving is the number one employer, right? And that's going to be disrupted in less than a decade, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yep. And that one is, you know, I mean, they're called Teamsters because they came from the team and wagon days, you know, and it takes less, you know, there's less stable needs, there's less driver needs, there's less maintenance of the horse needs, you know, all those things. There's been adaptations. It's just those ones that we can't see, like the thought experiment that we can't carry out to its logical conclusion. That's when it gets scary for us. But I'm pretty confident that the market is able to adapt to any disruption because it's done it over and over again.
Yeah, the only scary part to me is to not be cognizant of that potentially happening, of staying romantic in how you make your money and not being willing to adapt. Like, that's the only scary part. If you're willing to fly out to Cambridge and sit in a room and figure out all these different alternative possibilities, the opportunities are endless. But if you're just going to bury your head in the sand and say, I'm never going to change the way I do because anybody who does is stupid, that's the scary part. That's how you're going to go out of business.
Absolutely. Yep. And there's lots of development in the meat market. You know, I'm really excited about an episode that I'm trying to get nailed down here in the near future with a producer who has started a relationship with a grass finishing operation. They're taking cows and they're finishing them on grass, and now Tyson and Walmart are investing in that operation to see grass finished meat come to Walmart because they recognize Amazon as a competitor with the Whole Foods piece coming online. And, you know, those are Tyson and Walmart. They're interested in grass-finished beef, you know. So there's always two sides to that coin, and I think there always will be. Just our ability to adapt, improvise, and overcome is going to be the only question.
Well, is it a question, though? That's the only thing farmers are good at.
I did remember where I was going with that other nugget earlier, is you look at the technology in the most luxury vehicle you can find, and I'd say that it's still probably behind the technology in the most luxury tractor you can find because
oh, yeah.
the money. follow the money.
Yeah.
A consumer, the consumer market for those luxury vehicles is incredibly small. The production agriculture market for the most luxury tractor you can find is large. And so, yeah, you know, I get in my dad's 1993 John Deere, and it's light years ahead of a 1993 Cadillac. You know, I mean, it is. Yeah. It just, it's a, it's an incredible, incredible deal. So I think that's the way that's going to be. The money is there, and so the money is. But I think as we, as beef cattle producers, you know, start to become more concerned with profitability and sustainability, maybe that money comes along and the technology follows. So.
Exactly right. Well, and that was one of the points that I was trying to make. There was a group that was talking about what the potential market opportunity is of the meat industry, and to simplify the world animal protein market is $1 trillion or $990 billion. Like it's huge. So I see why that's so appealing for a technology, for a company to be chasing after that, in terms of a direct-to-consumer, a B2C market. But what I was trying to explain is that number is almost the exact same if you flip it and put it into the producer category. That is the basically the total amount of inputs that they're putting into this system in from a B2B perspective. So why are you not focusing on the B2B perspective? The inputs are the exact same number. It costs $1 trillion to make $1 trillion of meat on the consumer side. Like that, there's no difference. We do it to pay the bills, and that's it. There's not somebody who's taking $500 billion out of the system and putting that into their bank accounts. It stays in the economy. So it's the exact same number. So just chase it on the business to business side.
Very cool. Anything else we missed today? Any questions you wished I would have asked you?
No, I think that's pretty good. I think the final take-home that I had from the conference was that I truly believe that this type of technology, with how robust and how much resources are being put into it, how spectacular it is. Because really, when you think about animal agriculture and the types of technology that we get to utilize, we're usually at the mercy of academic institutions and larger organizations like pharmaceutical companies, which are so incredibly slow to move, right? It's infinitely frustrating with the amount of new technology that comes out. And certainly there's great strides. There's no question that academia and pharmacology companies or pharmaceutical companies have done spectacular things. But there's a lot of them doing it and a lot of money being spent. The thing that fascinates me so much about this space is how quick and smart and innovative these types of companies can be when it's the private sector doing something. I love I love all things capitalism. I love how nimble capitalism is, and to me this feels like a new wave of technology coming into animal agriculture that is purely based on this nimbleness that capitalism provides. So I love that. I love all of these new things that we could potentially utilize with these really aggressive companies. But I believe after the conference that we in animal agriculture need this technology in order for us to be sustainable and to survive. And on the flip side, I believe that cellular agriculture needs animal agriculture in order to bankroll all of the research and development they need to do before they can really get to that end goal, that consumer-facing product. So together, I think it is nothing but upside. The only people I believe that are going to lose are the hopscotchers, the ones that completely discredit agriculture and animal agriculture altogether from a conventional sense and just want to go past us and to go over us without this development of technology in between. I think it's too early stage for that. The company that wins is going to be this amazing problem solver creating these amazing solutions within conventional agriculture, and then they're just going to step that next little step into the human market.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate because it reflects what we've seen in the past. You know, it's the same thing we've seen over and over again in the market and how companies have taken products to market. You know, it's not the hopscotchers, as you said, the people that jump. It's the people who are willing to play the short game and then be patient with the long game. So,
100%.
Cody, anything else, or how can people keep up with you? Where can people go to find you and keep up with what you're doing?
Yeah, I have a website. It's just CodyKrillman.com, or you can just Google me, and you'll find a variety of fun resources and videos and all kinds of great things.
Yeah, very entertaining vlog. Definitely check that out. The podcast, I think you're in 10 episodes, is that right?
10 episodes into podcasts. That's been a very fun experience for sure.
Yeah. So, and he has the video component, so you can look at his handsome face. And
that's the first time I've ever been called handsome.
Well, there you go. I'm glad I could provide that service. So thank you for your time today, Cody. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Very interesting discussion there with Cody, and I appreciate him taking the time to join me for an episode next week. I honestly don't know what's happening. Dallas Mount reached out to me and said, hey, it's time for us to do an episode. I'm going to interview you. That's all I got. So I guess since it was Dallas's idea that I start a podcast, I'm going to hand the reins over to him for next week's episode, number 43, with me, I guess, and Dallas Mount. So tune in next week. I'm sure it'll be interesting.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.